are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 23rd, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Suja Thomas, Pierre and Sarah Peterson Professor of Law at Illinois College of Law, on Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. But first, it's not that they caved. It's that Chuck Schumer seems to have absolutely no plan.
None whatsoever.
Meanwhile, new Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board begins its assault on labor. Devin Nunes's release the memo is starting to smell a lot like Pizzagate. And ICE continues its terror campaign. That was quick. Trump to cut primary agency dealing with the opioid addiction by 95%. Mike Pence insists he knows Trump's heart, and it's nice.
Sounds so gay, Mike. Jesus.
And speaking of Mike's, Mike from PA would have won alert. Pennsylvania Supreme Court massive ruling means Pennsylvania will be getting bluer in just a matter of months. Meanwhile, Bank of America celebrates tax cuts by penalizing its low-income customers, and Trump kneecaps solar power with tariffs.
Yep.
All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's another Tuesday.
And we are ready to go.
We're ready to go here, ladies and gentlemen.
High energy.
Let's just start. We're going to bring in our guests slightly different format today. Our guest is coming a little bit later. That's fine. We're going to start with just the story. I mean, I don't know if you've seen on Twitter or on social media this release the memo hashtag, which is beyond stupid and craven and whatnot. But let's just for a moment give it some benefit of the doubt. The story goes like this, that Devin Nunes, the head of the House Intel Committee, has secured information that there was a massive abuse, a bigger than Watergate abuse of the FISA court and surveillance techniques by the FBI and presumably other agencies, but primarily abuse of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act during the 2016 election. Like I say, Nunes is the chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He is, of course, had to recuse himself on the question of Russian interference in the election and everything that's happening with the Trump thing. But he's been doggedly pursuing this breach of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Now, look, I think broadly speaking, most people that I respect take this stuff very seriously. I spent a lot of time talking about the abuses during the Bush years. And I think that this is important stuff. Like I say, I'm going to presume that Nunes, although he has released a series of reports, regardless of what it was about, Edward Snowden, that have been really severely debunked. But apparently, Nunes is refusing to share this report with the Justice Department. This, it's not even a report. It's a memo he's written up. He has shared it with over 200 members of Congress, but presumably sharing it with the Justice Department will let the moles or the bad apples in the Justice Department or the FBI find out about it.
Congress does not leak.
That's right. And so the FBI and the Justice Department have been denied access to this secret memo. And supposedly, for some reason, they're not releasing the memo, even though Glenn Greenwald and John Schwartz over at The Intercept outlined four very easy ways that the memo can be released. Trump can declassify anything he wants. That's one way you could release the memo. The second way you could release the memo is the House Intelligence Committee, of which he is the chair, can declassify any material they possess. He wrote it, so he clearly possesses it. Or, if you're worried about that, Nunes can go on the floor of the House and read it off, because the Constitution protects members of Congress from prosecution for any speech or debate in either House. Or he could leak it to the news media, because he wrote it. I don't even know if it's classified. I mean, who classified it? He wrote it. Maybe he classified it. I don't know. But they should release the memo and the evidence, because otherwise we have this type of speculation and we don't want Lou Dobbs to lose it over this.
Let's turn to the Justice Department and the FBI. Again, two agents, an agency and a department sworn to preserve the national security, violating law and order and the Constitution, and denying Congress the fulfillment of its responsibility, which is to oversee those two organizations. This is reprehensible. What do you think can be done the most expediently to preserve evidence and to bring people who are in positions of authority to bay to prevent further corruption?
Yeah. Look, I'm an alumnus of the Justice Department. I've worked with the FBI in a variety of different capacities. When I was at Justice, when I've been at the State Department, I have enormous admiration for the average FBI agent and their work.
The rank and file, this is not an issue. Yeah. The
but
people who lead those, the Department of Justice and the FBI, are corrupt, they're crooked, and they need to be removed forthwith.
The reputation of both institutions is stained, and the stain is spreading. I think the Attorney General has got to act in an extraordinary fashion. I don't think the new director of the FBI gets how serious this is.
He said with a straight face they've been lost.
Yeah. Look, Richard Nixon got toasted for 18 and a half minutes.
Okay. Do we even need to John Bolton complaining about Richard Nixon? See, folks, now, you know what you didn't hear in that clip at all was what the hell they were talking about. Because we don't know, because the memo hasn't been released. So, yes, release the memo. Release the morons. Unbelievable.
That's amazing.
All right. Well, let's.
We're run by people who think that, like, the big lesson of the 70s was that Richard Nixon was railroaded.
Yeah.
Going back to Dick Cheney, by the way, isn't it like Dick Cheney's main lesson from the Nixon era?
Yeah, give up less information.
Right.
Folks, it is still the month of January, which means that your New Year's resolutions have not failed yet. Because I think apparently the statute says that you have all through the month of January to fulfill them, as long as you get them started. How could Harry's tie into your New Year's resolution? I'll tell you how. One, you can be smarter with your personal finances. Save about $100 a year if you're a frequent shaver with Harry's. Also, up your game a little bit. Harry's products have won countless grooming awards, and they'll keep you looking and feeling great. For me, I happen to be a little bit more on the side of the savings of the money, but your mileage may vary.
I appreciate that. I didn't want to be the one to say it.
I mean, I will say this. My razor looks better. It's just that I don't necessarily.
Don't try to cover yourself.
Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price, which is why over 3 million guys have switched to Harry's. And some ladies, too. Harry's owns the factory. They're able to deliver amazing quality blades for just $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more you pay at the drugstore. Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades. They'll give you a they'll give you a trial shave set for free. It's not their free one. You're going to get one for free when you sign up at harrys.com/majority report. You just pay for shipping. You can claim your free trial or offer from Harry's today. It's a $13 value for free when you sign up. Just cover the shipping. Your set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, a 5-precision engineered blade with lubricating strip, and a trimmer blade, which is also, I would say, the other big selling point for me because of what I don't think people realize, but I have some asymmetry with my nostrils. I don't know if people have ever picked that up. And the blade helps me there. Also, you get the rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. To get your free trial set, go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. All right, let's get into what's taken place over the past 2 or 3 days. Obviously, we had a government shutdown that lasted only through the weekend. Over that weekend, we also saw an enormous outpouring of grassroots energy in the form of protest marches. And an indication that to the extent that there was a lot of anti-Trump sentiment a year ago, it still remains. I mean, you could also just look at the polling, right? But, and this is relevant because of the really, the, I mean, look, it's not over with the Democrats, the budget, and DACA. But it's very difficult to figure out what the strategy was here. I mean, even if you go back to December, do you remember there? This was not the first continuing resolution. The first one was in early December. And Nancy and Chuck met with President Trump. And he promised them that they were going to get an immigration deal. And so, and understand how this works, right? Like, I think Nancy Pelosi has been very good at being able to know her own caucus, be able to keep them in line. You never saw stuff where she brought stuff to a vote that it didn't pass. You never saw stuff where, I mean, she has a good relationship with the caucus. That is different than having a sense of how to develop a strategy. And speaking of not having a sense of how to develop a strategy, I'm not even sure if Chuck Schumer understands that's what he's supposed to be doing. Because he clearly had no sense of what his caucus could withstand. There was no reason to go and cause a shutdown if you weren't going to be able to maintain it. They could have gotten a 3-week deal on Thursday or Friday, if they were just going to take CHIP. And remember, there's no funding for community centers. Nobody's talking about that, but there's a lot of money cut at this point where you haven't had renewal for community-based health centers and Medicaid. And the CHIP funding, it's for 6 years, but it's not that expensive. And it's something that the Republicans theoretically wanted to do, too. So it's good that they got that out of the way, but they could have done it without doing a government shutdown. Just punted. Instead of showing, hey, look, we're going to show you all our cards. We're going to show you that we were bluffing here. Because next time, we're going to do what? Now that Mitch McConnell has promised?
Yes, his word. Which was also part of the last process.
Of course.
I mean, it's just
of course,
it's
and of course of the ACA, right? Remember, McConnell promised to vote on Collins Nelson. That was the Obamacare premiums. That's how Susan Collins ended up voting, or was supposedly going to voted for the tax bill, I should say. That vote never came before 2017, like promised. McConnell promised a vote on Alexander Murray. That was to stabilize the Obamacare markets before 2017. That was another promise to Susan Collins to get her to vote for the tax bill. Nope. McConnell promised to bring a DACA bill, a bipartisan DACA bill, to the Senate floor. Do you remember the Durbin-Graham bill vote? Oh, that's because that did not happen.
Right.
McConnell promised Republican tax plan would not raise taxes on anyone in the middle class. I mean, come on. Mitch McConnell's a liar. The Democrats know he's a liar. And if they think that because they have McConnell's promise on record that it's going to be easier for them to maintain the caucus in 3 weeks in February for a shutdown than it was today, they're deluding themselves.
I doubt it's even that. I think that it's just like they're planning on the ads that they'll run. And, you know, fair enough. He's a liar. We'll protect DACA recipients at some future date. But there's no plan.
Well, but here's the thing.
There's clearly no plan.
Here's the problem is that there may not be an opportunity to protect DACA recipients.
Absolutely.
We'll take it even putting aside the notion that DACA recipients right now are going through hell. And that's before any one of them gets deported, because they're all wondering whether or not they're going to be able to live in this country starting, you know, March 5th or whatever it is. Here's Sarah Huckabee Sanders talking about the notion of mass deportations of people in their 30s and younger who have been in this country for well over a decade in some instances, but all over a decade. Sent to countries that they may have absolutely no memory of.
I understand that you guys have laid out your criteria for what you want in a deal, but is the president saying that on March 5th, if he doesn't get what he wants from the Democrats in those other areas, that he will begin to deport the Dreamers?
We haven't determined that. We're hopeful that we don't have to do that and that we don't have to get there.
Well, I got news for you. You don't have to do any of it. You don't have to do any of it. But they are using... I hope you don't make us kill the hostages. That would be a real shame.
And I think... I guess I'm suggesting something more cynical, which is I don't think that... I mean, look, I don't think there's any doubt that Democrats would prefer a win. But I also think that they are at least comfortable with the notion that... Yeah, it is going to rain down on DACA recipients, and it's going to be horrible. And that is, along with all of the lies and incoherence, are going to make for good campaign ads. I think that there's just a lot of inbuilt acceptance on their part of some casualties as well.
I think the people who are voting for this, the Democrats who basically broke from the party, there was about 11 or 12 of them.
Those are mostly Trump state people.
They're mostly Trump state people. Some of them are in maybe purple districts where they're simply following their leadership in
not
some instances.
Coons, not Coons.
But I think they're missing the point. They think that immigration is going to be a bigger issue than Donald Trump.
Yep.
And there's just simply bad strategy here by those individual senators. There's bad strategy and bad salesmanship by Chuck Schumer. I don't think there is a strategy here. What could possibly be the strategy? I mean,
I saw a piece on Fox about how they're actually playing like 20-dimensional chess with this move or something.
The Democrats.
Was that an Ezra Klein piece?
Well, look, they very well may think that they are, and perhaps at the end of this, there's going to be DACA. Can anybody explain the strategy of this? That they couldn't, that somehow, like, everybody in February is going to remember, like, Mitch McConnell, your average voter in West Virginia or in North Dakota, and go, well, all the reasons I would have been upset about this immigration, this DACA thing, I'm not going to be anymore because Mitch McConnell made a promise to Chuck Schumer.
And to the extent to which they obsess about this stuff, just in the sense of like a day in and day out news cycle and playing all these little games that usually don't amount to much. I mean, they managed to look the worst in both directions, because they managed to, like, just atmospherically, some people are going to be like, wait, Democrats shut down government? Why? That doesn't make sense. I don't get it. You know, if they're just seeing headlines. And then they caved. Like,
right.
Days, like, it's just, they managed to, you know, I said it in the prep, like, it's like de Blasio and Hillary. Just endorse her and do it and be an establishment New York Democrat, or make your break and say, hey, I'm actually left. I'm endorsing Bernie. But he said, I'm going to wait and see what she does. And everybody's like, F you.
Right.
You're annoying.
Right. This is the classic case of, like, I'm not sure if I should cross the street. Let me stand in the middle of it.
Right.
And debate as to whether or not I should continue to cross or go back to the curb.
I mean, I wrote a piece on NBC Today about this very topic, and I think the Democrats...
NBC.
NBC's new opinion vertical. It's
fake
cool. Check
news,
it out.
Fake opinion.
But basically, you know, whether their intentions are good or not, and I believe oftentimes they are, it's time to judge these kinds of policies based on their actual outcomes. And the outcome in this case was not very good. And Democrats need to start listening to their progressive base when we say, you know, it's time to stop waffling on things that are this important. It's time to stop caving to policies driven by white supremacy and xenophobia. And I'm seeing tweets from even people who are quite centrist in
Well, that's what I was going to say. This is not even listening to progressive base. This is just like... It doesn't help the most centrist or even conservative of Democrats to be weak, to have no strategy, to have no strategy. There's no Democratic constituency that could be happy about this. There are some that may be trying to defend it. But there's no one going like, I knew they were going to do this. And this is what I was calling for. Hold out for the same deal that they could get on Friday, but just make it look like they'll cave. That was the plan. Who's saying that?
If I'm thinking of the same column that Jamie referenced before, Ezra Klein is borderline-ish saying that.
This is what I was hoping they would do.
Yep.
Threaten the government shutdown.
You never underestimate how delusional some of these people are. And how they still think, even inside this context, that they're playing some other highly trivial game with completely different rules. I just want to quote this. Jeff Stein, though, in contrast, who's a Vox reporter.
But wasn't this chip funding on the table already?
I mean,
like, was this
let's
deal
be honest,
not
I have
available
no doubt,
on Friday?
Well, probably. I have no doubt that Republicans might have, you know, portrayed chip. I mean, that seems very probable to me. They technically it's out of money beginning in September.
Look, I can tell you this. Beto O'Rourke, right? The guy's running in Texas. In December, he had tweeted out that he had a discharge petition on DACA, which basically is almost like the version of nuking the filibuster in the Senate. Okay? It means you can go around the leadership and bring a DACA vote around the thing. There's a lot of risk involved in this and whatnot. And he was told in December to avoid that, hold off, because in January we have the plan. Well, January is come and gone, folks. I mean, it's only January 15th or 23rd.
This is their Paul Ryan moment.
But they're going now, they've punted to February, past, understand, the State of the Union, which was the only leverage they had with Donald Trump. Like, there's a fundamental misreading of what's going on here. And I don't know. It looked to me like you could get that that chip deal on Friday.
Very despondent sounding Democratic aide. Democrats just showed their hand. McConnell has no reason to believe that they as a whole caucus will fight for a DACA fix.
Of course.
Yeah. It's
You've
so
just
simple.
Basically said like, look it. I got no way of getting a straight flush.
Yep.
But I'm going to pretend I do.
Just a heads up. I'm about to bluff.
Exactly.
If I may make an analogy, Marx differentiates between capitalist wealth and feudal wealth, where capitalist wealth is reinvested into things theoretically, and feudal wealth is just sort of hoarded and passed down through generations. And I think that the Democrats are hoarding their political capital like a bunch of feudal lords, they're just Scrooge McDucking it every night through their hoarded political capital to very mysterious ends.
I think that is, like, honestly,
almost giving them too
giving
much
them too much credit. Like, I don't think this story is like they're, you know, I think this is just incompetence. If you're Chuck Schumer and you're aware that you're going to lose 7 or 8 of your senators because they are too afraid to last 2 days into a shutdown, guess what you do? You don't shut down the government.
No, don't do
it. They still think that this is going to get them some kind of capital or leverage down the line for being quote unquote bipartisan when the other side is not playing by the same rules as them in any way, shape, or form.
There's not even any polling data suggesting anybody wants that. Yeah. I don't know. It's absurd.
All right. We got to take a break. Suja time.
Yes. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Suja Thomas. She's a professor of law at Illinois College of Law on how America's courts undermine our existing discrimination law. We'll be right back.
Come a day, you see the sun, hit the arch, a history song.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the Peer and Sarah Pedersen, Professor of Law at Illinois College of Law, Suja Thomas, author, or I should say co-author, of Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. And you've co-authored that with Sandra Sperino. Suja, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, all right, let's start with this. Tell us, there are three basic, I guess, statutes or a series of statutes that you address as making up what we commonly refer to as discrimination law. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, Age Discrimination and Employment Act, and the American Disabilities Act. Tell us, just, you know, broadly speaking about each one of those acts, what the law says, what the intent was of these laws.
Sure. Well, with respect to, I can really kind of broadly talk about all of them because they're very similar. All of them protect people against discrimination on the basis of various characteristics. And so Title VII protects against discrimination on the basis of race, sex, color, religion, or national origin. The ADA protects against disability discrimination, and the Age Discrimination and Employment Act protects against age discrimination if you're 40 or older. So each of these statutes is supposed to protect us against discrimination. Title VII includes discrimination on the basis of sex, which includes what we've been talking about a lot nowadays, sexual harassment. So yeah, those are the three federal statutes that we have.
And in what context do they protect us from discrimination?
If an employer discriminates against an employee on the basis of religion or sexual orientation, I shouldn't say sexual orientation because it's not covered yet, but sexual harassment, race, then you are supposed to be able to bring a lawsuit in court at a certain point in time and say, you know, my employer discriminated against me. I should be able to recover. For example, if I wasn't promoted or I was terminated, I should be able to recover from the employer.
Okay. So, and now are there enforcement divisions? Are there enforcement? So we have, on one hand, there is a big civil court system of enforcement, right? Where people mm-hmm. basically file tortious claims under one of these acts, or maybe multiple of these acts. Are there government enforcement agencies? Is there any other enforcement mechanisms for these things?
Sure, there are state agencies, but the federal government also has something called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The state agencies and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission can be a positive thing. For example, if you don't have a lawyer, maybe if they have the resources at the time that you come in to complain about discrimination, maybe they will help you resolve that dispute with your employer. But the problem is that these agencies are overwhelmed with charges of discrimination. Right now, right around fiscal year 2016, the EEOC received over 90,000 charges of discrimination. And so what happens is usually a charge of discrimination is filed, but usually the agency doesn't have the resources to actually deal with the issue. And one of the funny things about this is that this system is very different than sort of, let's say, you get into a car accident. If you get into a car accident, you can bring a case in court immediately. But if you have if you believe that your employer has discriminated against you and you're bringing a case under federal law, you have to actually go to the EEOC or the state agency, and you have to file a charge of discrimination within a shorter period of time than you would if you were bringing some other type of cause of action. So there are these hurdles that you actually have to climb to bring a discrimination claim.
Okay. And this is, and you know, we've talked a lot on this program about the importance of, you know, the metaphorically keeping the courthouse doors open to people, because, mm-hmm. access to civil courts are the primary instrument to hold people to account for these type of discriminations. And the law is basically the leverage and the fulcrum. When you start talking about these things, and this is really basically what your book is about, I don't need to tell you that, but when you start talking about these obstacles to bringing these cases, walk us through, you know, where they come from. So when so you have to file with the respective agencies, you have to do it within a certain amount of time. Is that a statutory requirement? And then from there, walk us through what happens once you make it to court and where those obstacles start piling up and why.
Sure. So exactly that there is this time period within which you have to file with the agency, and that is in fact a statutory requirement. So you have to do it in time, and if you don't do it in time, you're out of luck. You're done. But if you do it in time and you wait your period of time until you get what's called a right to sue, you can bring your case in court. Well, once you bring your case in court and you bring a complaint, with or without a lawyer, then the courts can actually decide that your claim is not plausible. And if the court decides when you bring your complaint of discrimination that your claim is not plausible, they can actually just dismiss the case. You can appeal that, but they can dismiss the case. That happens sometimes. But usually what happens is there's some exchange of information between the different parties, the employer and the employee, whether there be depositions, document exchange, interrogatories, question asking between the parties. Once that's completed, what's called discovery, almost invariably, an employer will make what's called a motion for summary judgment. And they're saying to a judge that no reasonable jury could find for the employee. Judge, you should dismiss this case. And the Federal Judicial Center, which is a body of the federal government, it found that over 70% of employment discrimination cases were being dismissed at this stage when employers requested dismissal. It's really an astounding number.
All right. Well, so let's put that number into context, okay? Because uh-huh. it's just to be clear here, folks, it's saying that these courts are saying that 7 out of 10 times when someone comes to the court after basically all the, not all the facts, but the vast majority of facts at least have been preliminarily exposed in this process of discovery, that there's no way this amounts, this is ever going to amount to what would be a discrimination case. First off, tell us relative, like, how that 70% summary judgment number stacks up against other cases. And then I want you to talk about some of the specifics, because when people start hearing the specifics as to what did not constitute even a possibility of discrimination, it is shocking.
Yeah, I mean, there are different stats for different types of cases in terms of percentages, but civil rights cases are far greater likelihood to be dismissed using this procedure. So the other cases don't really compare. In fact, the Federal Judicial Center kind of made it a point to say, you know, employment discrimination cases are being dismissed at this extremely high rate. And to put this into context, too, a federal judge has talked about how at what she calls baby judge school, they are actually instructed to get rid of these types of cases. To put a little bit of context into this as to the types of cases that are being dismissed on what I called summary judgment after this exchange of information, you know, we've been talking a lot about sexual harassment, and people, I think that, okay, if you have a claim of sexual harassment, if you go to court, that, you know, you'll have some relief. Well, you know, that's not going to happen. The likelihood is that it's not going to happen. And so, for example, there was a case involving a police department and a person who was working for a supervisor alleged that the supervisor had engaged in sexual harassment. He did a number of things. He called her a frigid bitch. He came to her driveway and told her son that he loved her. He suggested she wear certain jeans and said her ass looked fine. He said, I'd get an erection if you just walk into a room. He picked her up over his head in the office. He chased her around the office. He asked her over the phones if she was dressed or naked. And what they said, I didn't even name everything, but they said over 4 years, there were 16 specific instances. Only 3 times did he touch her or attempt to touch her, and much involved horseplay. It's not that frequent, mostly offensive utterances. So this isn't severe, pervasive enough to alter her employment terms or conditions. No chance that this survives. A reasonable jury could not find for her. We dismiss this case. The appellate court affirmed the trial court's decision. And we have case after case.
I just want this to marinate for a little bit so that people fully understand. Everything we just heard was not disputed by the court. Everything you just articulated was not the contention or whatnot. These were the facts, right, that were accepted by the court. And they said, with these accepted facts, there is no way a reasonable jury could find that this woman suffered any type of sexual discrimination at work. Right? I mean, that's
correct.
That's absolutely, like, it's stunning. Like, so how does a court justify that? How is this, like, institutionalized?
Yeah. So the first step of this, at least on the sexual harassment front, but this is not the case with respect to everything with respect to what we're talking about in the book, which is more generally discrimination. But on the sexual harassment front, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Meritor. And in the Meritor case, it set up this language that says you have to have severe, pervasive conduct to alter the employment terms or conditions and create a hostile or abusive working environment. And so what has happened since the United States Supreme Court said that is that there has been case after case where there have been really terrible facts, and the courts have said, no, that's not sexual harassment. And then the appellate courts affirm, and then other district courts have facts that are just as bad or maybe a little less than that, and they say, well, if that case wasn't good enough, this isn't sexual harassment. And you just have case after case where there's this terrible behavior, and either the United States Supreme Court language and in conjunction with what these courts of appeals, the appellate court below the United States Supreme Court is doing, is creating this really bad law that is really, you know, outrageous.
And so when was that Supreme Court case adjudicated?
It was in the 80s. Yeah.
Now, I mean, there's two things that occur to me. That one, when you have this filtered down, the sort of the questions of like the definition of pervasive and hostile and this and that, right? Like, it seems to me that society has definitely evolved in its understanding of what makes things uncomfortable. And you're also talking about a time where, like, the federal judiciary, I would imagine, as this case law is being developed, was, and probably still is to a certain extent, but at that time, I would imagine, overwhelmingly male and without really any expertise in sort of, you know, the awareness that being called, you know, being told that somebody's getting an erection when you come into work creates a hostile work environment. Like, maybe there just wasn't the ability, I'm being generous here, but to appreciate that makes for a very hostile work environment.
Yeah, I think you're right in all your comments. I do think though that even though we've evolved in our understanding of what is sexual harassment, I think in the 80s, people knew that you couldn't do what I, you know, just the facts that I just stated. I mean, I think people knew that. I think it was very clear that you were being treated differently because of your sex, which is the issue here. The language says you are not supposed to be treated differently, you know, because of sex. And so, as much as I think it's true that some people's concepts of sexual harassment have evolved, I think there's some basic, the type of stuff that we're talking about the book is basic stuff that you shouldn't have been doing in the 80s either, and that should never have been permitted.
But was the problem then that the Supreme Court rose the bar, like it took the bar beyond where the statute was?
Certainly. For one thing, this language is not required by the statute in any way. The statute has incredibly broad language. It's, you know, that says that it's an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discriminate against an individual with respect to their terms and conditions of employment because of sex, right? And that doesn't say anything about severe or pervasive or anything like that. And so the first thing, you're right, the first thing they did was erect the standard that is difficult to sort of say that, you know, something like, you know, someone calling someone a bitch or multiple times calling a bitch, is that severe? You know, I would say it's severe, but clearly courts aren't saying that's severe. So that's one of the problems. The second problem is the courts are interpreting that in an incredibly high way so that the types of facts that I've described are not deemed actionable.
Give us an example of race discrimination cases that have also been dismissed via summary judgment.
Yeah, there is a racial harassment case that was dismissed that has some pretty terrible facts that involve things like on a console they had a KKK on a bathroom wall in a block saw console. A supervisor said that if he looked at a white girl, he would cut him. Another supervisor called him black boy. There were rebel flags on toolboxes and hard hats. And that's And that's just, you know, some of what it was alleged, and that was dismissed. That case was dismissed, and that wasn't racial harassment. It's hard not to laugh. So that's another harassment case. There's just story after story of harassment cases, racial discrimination cases, sexual discrimination cases, retaliation cases, where someone complains about discrimination and then is retaliated against for complaining about discrimination, that these cases are being dismissed.
All right. So you talk about a number of legal doctrines that end up like doing the heavy lifting, I guess, in these instances, right, that provide the justification for summary judgment. Tell us about a couple of them. I know whether it's stray remarks or the honest belief rule McDonnell Douglas or whatever you think is most relevant for people to understand, because I'm not sure that people fully understand sort of like what judges have at their disposal in terms of like a toolbox in which to make these rulings.
Sure. I'll start with just one of them, the stray remarks doctrine. The idea here is that if a discriminatory remark is made too remote in time from the decision, or not made in the context of the decision, or it's too ambiguous, that the court will say it's a stray remark. There's no evidence of discrimination. Case dismissed. And so there was a case involving a middle school teacher and a coach of the football team. And when he was hired, the superintendent, black, the superintendent said when he was hired that they had had a problem in the past with black coaches, and if there was another problem, no matter what it was, that he'd do his best to get rid of this employee. And in the same conversation, the supervisor said he had had bad luck with black men working in the town. He was hired. There were some complaints against the person who was hired. And then the superintendent made the recommendation of not renewing the contract. And it wasn't accepted by the board originally, but then later on it was accepted. And the position was filled by a white female. And what the court said was that, giving the overwhelming evidence that supported their legitimate justification, these comments can just be viewed as mere stray remarks. So it's sort of like, okay, here you have these comments that are made by a guy who clearly has some, you know, issues with discriminating against people who are black. And then this guy is recommended to be fired, and he is fired, and they say that's irrelevant. And, you know, there were enough good justifications. Well, you can't really put the justifications into context unless you look at those comments, I think. And so that's one of the doctrines that gets used to say this case doesn't go to a jury. Now, again, what my co-author and I always say is, we're not saying there's discrimination. What we're saying is this case should go to a jury, and a judge shouldn't be deciding whether or not this case gets dismissed. Another doctrine that's used is something called the same or common actor inference. And the idea there is that if someone hires you and then they fire you, the same person fires you, they didn't discriminate when they hired you, so they can't discriminate when they fired you. So there was this guy who worked for a company, and the CEO hired him, and then the CEO made a number of age-related comments, like, you don't need to be remarrying a young woman again, you can't even get it up. He called him an old goat, said, you can't remember, you're just getting old. He told him that senility was setting in. And he had this evidence of discrimination by this CEO. But despite that, they said, you know, well, you know, he hired this person, and so he can't have discrimination. He couldn't have discriminated against him because he hired him. Well, the funny thing about this, I don't know if people might have seen this connection, but the funny thing about this is it's very inconsistent with the stray remarks doctrine, because stray remarks doctrine is saying you have discrimination at point A, but you do not have discrimination at point B by that same person. This other inference is saying you have no discrimination at the first point, and then you don't have discrimination at the second point. that the no discrimination doesn't disappear. So it's the Seventh Circuit, one of the federal circuit courts, has said, you know, this doesn't quite make sense. These doctrines don't, you know, really make sense together. So there is some recognition, but that some of this doesn't make a lot of sense.
Just to explain to folks, like, the taxonomy of a doctrine. Like, what is a doctrine, and you know, where does it come from?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So the courts, you know, look at statutes and they get to interpret what those statutes mean. So I earlier had talked about this very broad language in the statute that states that you can't, it's unlawful for an employer to discriminate because of sex. And so the United States Supreme Court said, with respect to sexual harassment, you know, that means severe or pervasive. So they create this doctrine that, that the courts have to follow. The lower courts can do the same thing. The United States Supreme Court gives them some law or doctrine to follow, but then the lower courts create these other doctrines. So, you know, they talk about the having the same actor make the decision, or the stray remarks doctrine that I just mentioned. And as Sam was kind of saying, it's like there's doctrine after doctrine after doctrine that's been created to say that, okay, well, this isn't discrimination and this isn't discrimination, when really what should happen is all of this information should just go to a jury and a jury should decide the question.
What do you say to the charge that, oh, well, but the point of these doctrines are to function as a sieve, so that scurrilous claims and frivolous claims, I guess, don't get through the system and don't waste our time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's possible to have a claim that is not a claim that is, in fact, discrimination, right? But one of the problems with discrimination claims is that it's not always clear the type of evidence that actually proves discrimination. That is, you could think that this piece of evidence proves that it's discrimination, and I can think that this piece of evidence does not prove discrimination, right? We may have disagreements, and that's where a jury is supposed to decide. And so, like, we set up it's called the Seventh Amendment. The Seventh Amendment says, you know, the jury is supposed to decide cases involving monetary matters. That's an exact quote from it, but that's what the meaning of the Seventh Amendment is. And so cases like this, factual disputes, were supposed to be decided by juries. They were not supposed to be decided by judges. That's what our Constitution set up. And so this idea of frivolous cases, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, yes, someone could bring a case that's, they didn't face discrimination, and they're just trying to get money. But there's really no evidence that this is a significant problem in the courthouse. There is no evidence of that.
The idea, I mean, almost definitionally, frivolous means, right, that if it goes to a jury, the jury's just going to laugh at the plaintiff, right? I mean,
so I think that's right. But what? Any of the cases that we're discussing in the book are like the cases that we've mentioned here on air. And so, yeah, is there a possibility of that there is a case that is frivolous out there? Yeah. But what I'm saying is that these doctrines aren't created for that. What they're doing is they're taking out cases that have good evidence of discrimination, and they're taking those cases out of the court system and saying no to people who have really good evidence that they may have been discriminated against by their employer.
Why do you think this exists? This dynamic exists. I mean, it's one thing to watch Congress and the Supreme Court, frankly, either legislate or rule in such a way that favors corporations, broadly speaking, and shuts down the ability of citizens to go and get redress in the one area they can. Why, in this instance, Is that what we're, I mean, we haven't seen it so much from a legislative standpoint, because like you say, this is a, what these judges are doing on a day in, day out basis is narrowing significantly what was clearly the statutory intent. But where, what is coming from this? Is this a cultural problem? Is it one where the judges just tend to side with white people and men, or is it one where they just tend to side with employers over employees? I mean, what's the dynamic that's going on here that leads to a 70% summary judgment dismissal rate?
Yeah, I mean, I think one, we have to think about who are the people who are deciding these cases, and you know, how were they selected, right? All of these people, and we're talking about the federal courts right now, were selected by the President of the United States. That is an incredibly elite group of people, right? And they have a very, for the most part, have a very different background than the vast majority of the people in the country, and. Because of that, you're limiting a viewpoint. I'm not saying every federal judge has the same viewpoint, but I'm saying that each of those people has a particular viewpoint, and some of it is influenced by, you know, being a lawyer, being an elite lawyer, being now a judge. And so we've got that. Oftentimes, the federal judges have prosecutorial backgrounds. They have corporate backgrounds. And so we have that in the mix as well. In terms of other types of diversity, most of the federal bench is male, and you referred to this earlier. 65% of the people who are on the bench that are active are male versus 49% of the general population in at least the most recent census. If you look at the actual number of active and senior judges, it's even higher that the percentages of the percentage of males. You also have a high percentage of people who are white, and which isn't to say that white people or males can't be fair. The issue is that we all, in a jury, you actually deliberate, right? We talk to each other, we talk about the evidence, and we make a decision as a group. There are no deliberations outside of the appellate context. There's pressure to dismiss cases. There's a 6-month list. If you don't decide within 6 months, you're on a list. And there was a study that showed that there were more dismissals at that point in time, closer to that 6-month period. Judges can be promoted. I mean, not it's not going to happen often, but they can be promoted. They also don't want to be reversed, right? So they're going to make decisions where they don't want to be reversed. And so if you're seeing cases being dismissed over and over again, you're going to say, well, it's better if I actually dismiss this case, this type of case, a case which involves employment discrimination, because I'm less likely to be reversed. I don't think there's some potential effect with political parties, but a couple of the cases I was involved with when I was a lawyer, both of the judges who were involved were, you know, Democratic appointees. So it's not, a kind of a clear case of this is a Republican-Democrat issue. This is you see this with Democratic appointees as well as Republican appointees. So these are some of the things, and, you know, clearly you see a bent towards employers with all of these factors coming into play.
Suja Thomas, the book is Unequal, How America's Courts Undermine Discrimination Law. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put that on our site at majority.fm. Once again, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half in just a moment. However, I have an important announcement. It is Lawyer Matthew's birthday today. Big 5-0. The big 5-0. Yes. He's come a long way. We used to bathe together, Lawyer Matthew and I.
What was that, like 2000?
What's that?
Like 2000 or so?
We both made the same joke
all
at the same time.
All through the 80s, 90s, and the aughts. Yep.
Who has a better technique?
We would
It's more of a joint technique.
Yeah, really. I mean, you don't understand the spirit of bathing together.
Absolutely true. I do not bathe with other men.
It's making it like it's a competition.
Everything's a competition. Not a better. You wouldn't know that. Have a Luna bar.
Yeah, there you go. So happy birthday, Lawyer Matthew. Also, folks, just a reminder, this show exists because of your support. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. We just got a 5-pound bag. Where is that bad boy? 5-pound bag of the Majority Report blend. And Brendan's eyes lit up. I don't know if you... Like, Brent, I was like, Brent, what kind of coffee should we get from Just Coffee? He's like, I actually like the Majority Report blend the best.
I like the Majority Report blend, boss.
I mean, I think to a certain extent, it's hard to, you know, you're not sure, right? Like, is this guy, what's going on here? Somebody trying to butter me up for a raise?
That's interesting.
Or, like, is this...
you know, speaking of which, I like 3 square meals a day. You think we could talk?
justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You will get 10% off. Also, today is Tuesday. You know what that means. TMBS day.
Hello.
Who's going to be on tonight on TMBS, Michael?
Noah Changa to talk about a recent trip she made to Puerto Rico and some rebuilding efforts there. And then Anthony LaPay is in studio, and we're doing the hidden... This is more like an illicit history segment that we're going to give as a kind of... new content, but quasi-teaser for the public show on the history of the opioid crisis.
Going back to Laos.
Yep.
There you go.
And the parallels between how cartels build markets and how the opioid epidemic was spread by pharma companies and the role of the Giuliani group in it.
There you go.
We do a lot of stuff.
And also,
Why do you hate that we're here right now talking about stuff?
I like how
fun
that works
to make fun of Gavin McInnes
on so many levels. That could be Sam at me. That could be basically Sam at me.
Also, you'll be checking in on the Bernie Sanders, the big Bernie Sanders healthcare event.
We will
tonight.
Be dipping in and out of the Bernie Sanders healthcare event. That's right.
And Jamie, when's your next piece going up on Jamie Peck's Patreon?
Oh my God, this is stressing me out a little bit. I was going to get it up today, and then I got 2 last minute assignments in yesterday for money, so I had to do those first, but I finished it, and I sent it to my friend Sophie Wiener to edit. She's a very good editor, so I'll probably be up sometime tomorrow.
Wiener.
There you go.
What? I'm sorry.
That's your takeaway?
Yes. Well, no, my takeaway, and not to give you too much heat, though, is that Patreon is a paid service as well, Pectreon.
Yeah, you the know, deadlines are a little looser.
The deadlines are definitely looser, but it's not like, you know.
Listen to this guy. Oh, incidentally, boss, Thursday, Friday, I'm going to be going out of town. I'm going to do some promotional
tour.
That's
different. I'm just clawing some of my time back from you robbing from me in your capitalist exploitative relationship, Sam.
Well, the patrons are also
the patrons are bosses. That is true.
They are
your collective bosses. I prefer to
think of
them as constituents.
It's going to be a scorcher, I promise. It'll be worth the wait.
There you go. All right, folks.
Scorcher. It's worth the wait. See you next week.
Tomorrow on this program, James Risen.
Oh, that's a big one.
Big one.
Big guest.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. What were you going to do? Matt was about to say something. 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920. We've got some clips in the fun half. We've got some fun in the fun half. Some half in the fun half. We've got it all, ladies and gentlemen, plus the IMs.